There has been a lengthy period between conviction and the date of sentence, as it has proved to be very difficult to get all the necessary reports prepared. There have been a number of short hearings to monitor progress. At some of those hearings, I expressed my concerns as to whether sufficient importance was being given to the assessment of your current medical and mental health condition. I now have various reports, and I will refer to them in the course of these sentencing remarks. Turning to the facts that give rise to the convictions, you met Dalton Hoth, and within a relatively short time, that relationship saw the birth of two sets of twins. Kyson and Bryson were born on the 14th of January 2017, and Logan and Leighton almost a year later on the 11th of January 2018. At the time of their deaths, the older twins were 4, the younger ones 3. You and Dalton separated when the younger boys were about 6 months old. As a result, much of the responsibility for day-to-day care of those 4 children fell to you. Your parents, Dalton's grandmother, mother and stepfather, and to some extent Dalton himself, all played a role in assisting with care. In December 2021, you were living at 118 Collingwood Road in Sutton, a private rental address. School and nursery staff spoke about the lively nature of the 4 boys. They were clearly deeply loved by all who had any role in their care and development. At about 6:30 p.m. on the 16th of December 2021, you left 118 Collingwood Road. The phone record showed calls between you and 2 friends between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. that day. You were on a call between 6:16 and 6:32 p.m. There is then a 4-minute period where there are no calls, but you are then on another call from 6:36 p.m. for the next 35 minutes. Both those calls are between you and Stephanie Belogan. She makes the call at 6:16 p.m. and you call her at 6:32. Stephanie said the conversations the two of you had that day were nothing out of the ordinary. The two of you were laughing and joking. To her, you seem fine. She says that the last call with you ends abruptly, no doubt for reasons that are now obvious. When you left 118 Collingwood Road that evening, you went to Sainsbury's. Earlier that day, you had gone to that same shop with the 4 boys. On this later visit, the shopping receipts showed you purchase a few items, but none that could be said to be essential or vital. Having left your home and the boys, those living in neighbouring properties were alerted to a fire at your home at about 6:50 p.m. One neighbour, Pradeep Nimaslina, heard a child from the upstairs window say several times, "There's a fire here." He called back to tell Bryson, the name he knew for one of the boys, to keep away from the window. The first 999 call was made at 6:54 p.m. and the first fire engine to arrive was there within minutes. At 7:02 p.m. 2 more fire engines arrive and fast work is done to extinguish the fire. Firefighters have been alerted to there being 4 children in the house. When firefighters locate the stairs, they find a mattress and a door laying on the staircase. Once they get to the front upstairs bedroom, they locate the bodies of the 4 boys and each is removed. Despite extensive first aid care, the 4 boys sadly died. By 7:12 p.m, firefighters have confirmed the 4 casualties. You are captured on CCTV in Sainsbury's at 7:03 p.m, paying for items that you had purchased. Your return home is timed by those at the scene between 10 past and 7:15. The call with Stephanie Balogun that I mentioned earlier ends shortly before 7:12 p.m, and so that timing would appear to be accurate. After the fire and at trial, you suggested someone called Jade was with the children when you were out, but that was not the case. The true position is that you had left 4 boys, aged under 4, four and under, on their own. There was evidence that the front door needed to be locked to prevent the boys inadvertently getting out when you were present, and whilst it's not possible from an examination of the front door handle to say for certain if the locking mechanism was engaged, it is very likely the four children were unable to get out. Some light bulbs in the house did not work, and so there was a reliance on tea lights to provide sufficient light. You were convicted of four counts of unlawful act manslaughter. The basis of the case was that you went out, leaving four boys unattended in the unsafe conditions of the house, that you abandoned them. Had you been at home when a fire started, you may have been able to extinguish it, or if not, you would have been able to get the children safely out of the house. But you were not there, and the children were too young to know what to do. As a result of what you did, they were all killed. This fire happened on a December evening, when it would otherwise have been dark. The likely cause of the fire is a tea light or an unextinguished discarded cigarette. The fire investigation revealed numerous manufactured cigarette ends, cigarette packets, tea light cases, both used and unused, joss sticks and disposable lighters in the front living area where the fire started and took hold, with particular concentrations of such items in the area of two parts of the sofa in that same room. I note the absence of working smoke or carbon monoxide alarms. There were such devices in the premises, but they were either inoperable by reason of no battery or low battery, or were not functional. There are no other words to describe this case as anything other than a deeply tragic one. The lives of four young children gone in just a few moments through an intense fire. Photographs from before the fire show four lively and engaging boys. I have no doubt they were or could be a handful, but as family as well as staff from school and nursery speak, the care and love you showed them is clear. It is of significance that you were acquitted of an offence of neglect, as that, in my view, reflects that the jury found you were otherwise doing your very best to care for the children, despite the appalling condition of the house that you were living in. There was no working bathroom or flushing toilet, and the kitchen was unusable. It will be for others to look into why you and the children were permitted to live in such conditions. In terms of victim impact, very moving statements from Dalton Hoth, Jason Hoth, Kerry Hoth, Casey Hoth and Sally Johnson about the profound impact on them of the loss of these four very young boys and the way in which their worlds have been turned upside down by the loss have been read in this court as part of this sentencing process. At trial, evidence was placed before the jury as to social services involvement between 2018 and 2021. Despite the record made at one home visit on the 20th of January 2020, suggesting a follow-up visit, that did not happen. The health visitor who completed that visit suggested you should have been on an enhanced plan that would have provided you with the required and necessary level of support needed to address the clear decline noted in living standards and concerns as to mental health. No explanation other than the possibility the pandemic was given as to why that was not addressed. Efforts were made to undertake a further visit in July 2021. One short visit took place on the 12th of July, and then a further brief visit on the 15th of July. Following that later visit, the family support worker who attended sent an email to her manager setting out her concerns as to the state of the home, your mental health, and the support worker not being able to see the boys. But there was no follow-up or further engagement prior to the fire. Reports on your mental and physical health. Before trial, a number of reports were prepared to shed some light on the state of your mental health at the time of the fire. Extracts from those reports were placed before the jury. Firstly, from April 2024, Dr. Adam Jarvis, a clinical psychologist, noted you then presented with evidence of a number of mental health disorders, depressive disorder, generalised anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, social anxiety disorder and dissociative disorder. Dr. Vivek Bisht, a consultant forensic psychiatrist, saw you on the 1st of March 2024. In his opinion, the primary diagnosis was of recurrent depressive disorder. He observed that there appeared to be clear evidence of deterioration in your mental state for several months leading up to the fire. Medical records referred to indicate you had approached your GP with feelings of low mood, periods of tearfulness, inability to cope, erratic sleep pattern, diminished appetite, loss of weight and lack of motivation. Dr. Bisht observed there was information you were struggling to cope, being quarantined during the COVID-19 pandemic with little or no support to care for the children. You were commenced on an antidepressant but were only compliant with medication for a brief period. He also noted you requested help with regard to low mood in April 2021, as things had further deteriorated to the point where you were struggling to hold on to your job. You were then found unfit to work, and that position had been repeatedly renewed at the time of the fire. His opinion was that you were clinically depressed at the material time, but there was no evidence you were psychotic. He added that it is recognised depression can lead to impairment in attention and concentration, muddled thinking with poor judgment and decision making, and this might explain some of your actions on the day. In June 2024, Dr. Paula Murphy, a forensic psychiatrist, expressed the view that there was a high likelihood that you had an underlying personality disorder with borderline traits, and a high likelihood you have recurrent depressive disorder. She also observed it is likely you were not coping at the time of the alleged offences and that your living space was one of the manifestations of this. These observations on your mental and physical health must be seen alongside the evidence of events on the day of the fire, and in particular what is said about the phone conversations you had with friends where nothing of concern was raised. Immediately before the start of the trial, your physical health was a concern. There were clear signs of a need for treatment to your eyes following a visit you made to a high street optician who found severe optic disc swelling. That optician referred you to the acute eye service at St Helier Hospital on the 22nd of August 2024. The hospital carried out an examination, and having done so, sent you to the emergency department for urgent investigation into the cause of the condition. You chose to self-discharge before those investigations could take place. On the 28th of August, you made contact with the eye department, saying you were unable to attend for a planned appointment. This was highlighted to the ophthalmology team, who found you'd not stayed for the planned urgent investigations. When this trial was due to start, a question of permitting you to go to hospital local to this area arose. It was only when I made very clear what would happen if you did not attend hospital that you appeared to appreciate the gravity of the position of your physical health and that this trial was about to start. Emergency treatment was then given, the trial process adapted so that the trial could continue. I note from the various reports I have read that a number of those who've seen you, addressed you, assessed you and reported on you have highlighted a degree of positive disengagement at times by you. Since the end of the trial, time has been given for the preparation of further reports. As I've already stated, this has taken rather longer than anyone anticipated. I now have a mental health treatment requirement assessment report from Dr. Claire Bingham, a consultant clinical psychologist, dated the 13th of November of last year. For various reasons, as set out in the report, such a course of treatment was not then recommended. There is a pre-sentence report dated the 14th of November 2024. Consideration to all sentencing options. It is clear from the start of that report that the author had not been able to address all the matters they would normally look at due to a lack of engagement on your part. I note the observation at the end of the report. Open quotes. Given there is no clear treatment plan in place for her mental health issues and the challenges she faces in engaging with services, I remain unconvinced about her motivation, and I find myself in some difficulty in recommending any community disposals at the current time. There is a letter dated the 13th of November 2024 from Dr. Rosewell Martin, a locum consultant urologist, addressed to the consultant ophthalmologist, Dr. Charlotte Funnell. In the letter, Dr. Martin sets out the results of the examination as to sight loss through what is described as idiopathic intracranial hypertension. The report ends as follows. I'm afraid there are not any other medical strategies outside weight loss that can be of use in IIH, so that if she continues to decline lumbar puncture, there is little further we can offer from the neurology clinic. So I was not sure how helpful it would be to bring her back to this department at the moment. Dr. Funnell's reports deal with an examination on the 24th of October 2024, a report of the history of the events and an analysis dated the 18th of October 2024, which covers the occasion when you self-discharged from St. Helier and then received emergency treatment in September. Also dated the 14th of October 2024 is a further report from Dr. Paula Murphy, the forensic psychiatrist who had prepared two reports before trial. In her report, she sets out in some detail the current position as best she could ascertain it. The ultimate conclusion of her report was to suggest admission to hospital to, as she puts it, fully assess her, ascertain her diagnosis, conduct a full risk assessment, including impact of her mental health on her offending and on her future risk of reoffending, and to provide treatment. As a consequence, this court was asked to give consideration to the imposition of an interim hospital order. Due to some questions on your medical health posed by her, a further report also commissioned from Dr. Funnell. Dr. Funnell's additional report is dated the 13th of December. By the 20th of December last year, a joint report from Dr. Bianca Inger and Dr. Maria Fotiadu was available. As set out, Dr. Murphy's report from the 14th of November raised the question of the imposition of a hospital order under the provisions of the Mental Health Act, with admission to the secure psychiatric services where you could have a more detailed assessment of your mental health. And so they undertook an assessment focusing on this recommendation and specifically to see if you met the criteria for such a detention. Dr. Maria Fotiadu is a consultant forensic psychiatrist with the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust, and Dr. Bianca Inger, a consultant forensic psychiatrist, the Oxleys NHS Foundation Trust. Both are members of the Royal College of Psychiatrists and approve the purposes of Section 12(2) of the Mental Health Act 1983 as amended in 2007. I note from their joint report, she accepted she needed support to address her previous traumatic experiences, her bereavement and anything else the team would recommend, and would be willing to engage in such assessments and interventions in the community, providing support is offered to access the appointments. She was unsure what other specific help she might benefit from, but welcomed any support her community psychiatric team or social services would offer, especially once a comprehensive occupational therapy assessment of her flat and activities of daily living can be conducted and specific recommendations made. There was no evidence of thought disorder, and there was no psychotic symptoms identified. Having set out the details of their examination, their conclusion is as follows. It is our opinion that Ms. Rose presented with a mild depressive disorder with anxiety symptoms, in addition to post-traumatic stress disorder, on a background of significant trauma prior to the index offence linked with domestic violence, as well over the last 3 years following the death of her children, compounded by the recent deterioration in her physical health. We have carefully reviewed the information available to us, and based on our current assessment, it is our view that her mental disorder is not at present of nature or degree to warrant or make appropriate detention in a hospital for assessment and or medical treatment. Medical treatment at hospital is currently not necessary nor justified in the interests of Ms. Rose's health or safety, or for the protection of others. Any treatment can be offered in the community. We have identified the risks to others as being low at present. However, it is important to highlight that risk needs to be assessed if she were to have children in the future. Ms. Rose would benefit from a psychological therapy to address trauma. As stated, she is in agreement with this. She will also need a comprehensive occupational therapy assessment of her environment and her daily needs regarding her poor vision. Her physical health needs are complex, and they are no doubt impacting on her mental health distress, as widely acknowledged. Clarifying first her diagnosis, as well as having further information regarding the treatment and management plan, will be extremely important for Ms. Rose, and we trust that colleagues from both ophthalmology and neurology departments are addressing this. The need for involving Ms. Rose in her treatment and management plan with clear explanations and information on risks and benefits of the interventions remains important, and she may wish to be supported either by her family or her community team when complex decisions are made. As such, it was made clear that as at that date, a hospital order was not an option, and so at the hearing on the 20th of December, I set today's date for sentence. In addition to the reports I've identified so far, there is an updated pre-sentence report, as well as a further mental health treatment assessment. Both of these reports were made available yesterday. In essence, if not sentenced to immediate custody, an MHTR is now suggested to be appropriate. I note in particular what is set out in the summary of the interview that was conducted for the later assessment compared with the earlier assessment last November, and also the concerns raised should a custodial sentence be passed. The latter interview shows far more engagement by you. However, as the updated pre-sentence report realistically sets out, an immediate custodial sentence is likely given the seriousness of the offence. On your behalf, it is submitted the impact the offence has had on you cannot be overstated. Whilst it is accepted you are criminally responsible for the death of your children, it is submitted in the light of all of the features of the case, you, your background, and the position at the time. Your culpability is low and mitigated by the clear and apparent mental health issues existing in the lead-up to and at the time of the index offences. It is also submitted that since the fire, you've lived in almost complete isolation, have lost all contact with friends, and only have the support of your mother. It is said that you've been ostracised by almost all those who knew you and have been subjected to sustained and frightening abuse online, and that you are afraid to leave your home through fear of reprisals. The loss of your children has only been compounded by the swift and irreparable loss of your vision. In determining any punishment, this court is invited to consider the severe limitations you will inevitably have to undergo. On your behalf, it is submitted this case is one that falls within Category D, and one where the only care that is needed can be given if a non-custodial sentence is imposed. It is said that the package of mental health care proposed is what is required to rehabilitate, and that a suspended sentence will ensure compliance. It is also submitted that an immediate sentence in prison is not what is required. Ms. Power submits the reports paint a picture of someone who is struggling to cope and seeking help at times long before the fire. She points to the long history of involvement you have had since your teens with social services. She highlights parts of the history prior to the fire and what is described as a perfect storm of acute mental and medical health issues. Ms. Power points to the impact on you of the loss of the boys. There is also the loss of your vision and not now being able to see photographs and films of the boys. I have all of those points well in mind. These features of the case all make this a very complex and difficult sentencing exercise. Turning to the sentencing guidelines, the Sentencing Council definitive guidelines on unlawful act manslaughter clearly apply. I need first to consider culpability. Considering the characteristics listed in those guidelines and seeking, as the guidelines state, to avoid an overly mechanistic application, I note A factor in culpability, B, death was caused in the course of an unlawful act which involved a high risk of death or grievous bodily harm, which was or ought to be obvious to the offender. In culpability C, I note, where death was caused in the course of an unlawful act which involves an intention by the offender to cause harm, or reckless as to whether harm would be caused, that falls between high and low lower culpability. It may be argued that each equally fits the characterisation of this case. I observe in culpability D, factors indicating lower culpability, the offender's responsibility was substantially reduced by mental disorder, learning disability, or lack of maturity. The guidelines use the term substantially. On your behalf, as I've said, it is submitted that this case comes within culpability D. I do not agree. The state of your mental health at the time of the fire had some impact, but on the information available to me, I do not find your responsibility to have been substantially reduced. The start point for sentence for culpability B is one of 12 years custody and a range of 8 to 16 years custody. For culpability C, the start point is 6 years custody with a range of 3 to 9 years custody. A note to the guideline sets out as follows. Where a case does not fall squarely within a category, adjustment from the starting point may be required before adjustment for aggravating or mitigating features. A further note to the guidelines makes clear that the table setting out start points and ranges of sentence is for a single offence of manslaughter resulting in a single fatality. Here there are 4 offences, 4 fatalities, and in my judgment, concurrent sentences reflecting the overall criminality are appropriate. Although I have mentioned both culpability B and C, in my judgment, culpability C is where this case falls. However, as to some extent, it doesn't fall squarely into that categorisation, but perhaps more significantly, as there are 4 deaths, an adjustment is required to the initial start point for culpability C before looking at the aggravating and mitigating features. In my judgment, that start point, before looking at those factors increasing seriousness and those factors reducing seriousness, is one of 12 years custody. Turning next to factors increasing seriousness identified in the guidelines, I need to have regard to the fact that you were a heavy smoker and that there was extensive use of candles or tea lights for added light in the home. As such, it might be thought that the risks of fire in a house where the living spaces actually used were very cramped and where there was discarded rubbish around the home were significant. You were the mother of 4 boys, and there is an element of abuse of a position of trust. Your children were particularly vulnerable due to their age, and it is clear that the last moments of their young lives would have been with some acute physical suffering as the fire took hold and they sought to get away from it. It is also the case that others were put at risk of harm, including those neighbours and firefighters who attended. I cannot ignore your actions after the event in providing the account that there was a babysitter looking after the children. Not only did that result in another entry into the building with further risk to the firefighters, but it also led to extensive police inquiry as to their whereabouts. In setting out these factors, I need to be careful not to double count for those factors that impact on the initial assessment as to culpability. On factors reducing seriousness or reflecting personal mitigation, you have no previous convictions and have expressed remorse. It is clear that you will have to live with the knowledge that you bear responsibility for the deaths of your 4 children. I note a lack of premeditation and the impact of your current medical and mental health, as well as your personal background and circumstances. I have already referred to the reports on your mental health that form part of the evidence at trial. I have considered the guidelines on sentencing offenders with mental disorders. In doing so and applying the guidelines, I should make an initial assessment as to culpability in accordance with the offence-specific guidelines, and then consider whether culpability was reduced by reason of the impairment or disorder. As the guidelines provide, culpability will only be reduced if there is a sufficient connection between any impairment or disorder and the offending behaviour. In that making that assessment, I've reflected on the impact of those reports as to the likely position in 2021 and the more recent reports. Reports post-conviction deal with your current medical and mental health position. The current position is somewhat different to the position back at the time of the fire and the deaths. It is very likely to be the case that serving any sentence imposed in the light of your eyesight and mental health issues will make that harder on you than on others, and I have sought to incorporate those matters in assessing the factors reducing the seriousness of the offence. In my judgment, to some extent, the factors increasing seriousness and those reducing seriousness balance each other out. However, in the light of all the submissions made, I reduced the sentence to one of 10 years' custody. As I've noted in the course of submissions this morning, you do not have the mitigation of a guilty plea. Whilst this conviction requires me to consider dangerousness, and some of the reports I've referred to address the risks going forward, I do not find the test to be met here. Turning to sentence, on each of counts 1 to 4, there will be concurrent sentences of 10 years imprisonment. You will serve 2/3 of that sentence in custody. If your case is referred to the parole board, you may then be eligible for release at that point and will be entitled to release at the end of the custodial term. You have been on a qualifying curfew for 114 days, and so 57 days will count towards the sentence imposed. As the statutory surcharge applies, the appropriate order may be drawn up. I have asked my clerk to prepare a file of all the medical and mental health reports that I have seen, and that file will accompany you to prison, along with a copy of these sentencing remarks.